This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Jim Matheson, CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Modern Ag Alliance. Learn more at their website, controlweedsnotfarming.com. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with NRECA's Jim Matheson next. They don't get sick days and no overtime pay. They report directly to Mother Nature, who loves to throw a good curveball. So why is the litigation industry fighting legislation and continuing to push lawsuits against a proven product that is a farmer's best defense against weeds? American farmers have been doing what's best for their land for generations, and they rely on glyphosate as a safe, affordable, and effective tool to control tough weeds and get the job done. No one knows how to feed and fuel a growing population better than the American farmer. But if our farmers lose a critical tool like glyphosate, they'll be stuck with just two options: grow less food or rely on foreign countries. Our farmers need to be supported. Keep glyphosate available for American farmers. Show your support and learn more at controlweedsnotfarming.com. Paid for by Modern Ag Alliance in support of America's farmers. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. The nation is faced with the challenge of maintaining a reliable and affordable supply of energy while at the same time protecting the environment. Jim Matheson, CEO of the NRECA, says American energy demand is increasing at a time when new environmental regulations threaten the supply of baseload capacity. Matheson says the nation's 900-plus electric cooperatives are being pushed to grow while new regulations threaten their ability to serve rural communities.
We've got a lot more manufacturing coming onshore in this country today. And so while industrial electric demand has been flat for the past 30 years, now it's growing, and it's projected to grow significantly over the next several years. In fact, there was a recent analysis where people changed their projections for how much power we're going to need in this country in the next 5 years, and it's roughly 38,000 gigawatts. So what does that mean? That's the equivalent of the entire electric load of California. We have to add another California's worth of demand to our grid in the next 5 years. It's a substantial uptick in terms of the electric sector in general. It's going to require a lot of investment in generation, also in transmission. I think the industry is up to the task, but this is going to be a real challenge to meet that demand.
So when we're talking about generation, what are our options, and what would it take to satisfy that amount of demand?
It's a great question, because the options in terms of what you can build quickly and efficiently is basically natural gas generation. That is, if you were to, on a greenfield basis, you said, I need you to build X amount of power generation, and you were asked with that to do that task, that would be the most immediate, cost-effective, and timely way to meet that need. The challenge is that in the public policy world, this new rule proposed by the EPA is going to restrict any new natural gas generation based on a set of requirements that are unachievable. So the most viable on-the-shelf technology for new generation, the EPA is saying, we're not going to let you build anymore unless you can deploy a technology that, as I said, we don't think is ready for prime time for natural gas. Outside of that, you've got a tremendous amount of renewables that are being proposed in this country, whether wind or solar. And renewable sources have a value as part of a portfolio. There's no question about it, but they are not always available resources. They're what is called in the industry intermittent resources. So they can play a role as part of the portfolio, but you have to be really careful about changing the balance of that portfolio too far in the direction of resources that aren't always available, because then you bring into the question the basic need of reliability of this grid, where everyone in America, they never even think about it. When they walk in a room and flip the switch, the lights go on and they don't even give it a second thought. We want to maintain that level of reliability going forward. So that's the other kind of generation I see a lot coming online, is going to be the renewable generation. But you've got to have that always available generation as well, and gas is the easiest one to build.
Anyone who's ever worked with an electrician knows that you've got to have the right size wire to carry the amount of load that's going to be on that particular circuit. So let's take that up to the national level. is the transmission system up for this type of an increase in load capacity?
Not today. It's not. In fact, we've seen a real lack of investment in the last few years in our transmission system for a lot of reasons, by the way. If you want to move forward with this increased demand, and also if you want to improve reliability in our country, you need to expand the ability of the transmission grid to move power between different regions of the country. So if there's a significant weather event that spikes electric demand in one part of the country, more power can flow from other parts of the country. So that's the second factor. The first you asked in your question, just meeting the demand in general. But the second is, how do we improve reliability at the same time? It's going to require a lot of investment in high-voltage transmission lines to move large quantities of power over long distances.
How has base load supply changed? Are we up, down, or static?
I would say that it's probably changed a bit in the sense that you've had a number of always available or base load plants shut down over the last few years, but you have had others built, and really it's been a shift from coal to gas. And a lot of that's been driven by economics, quite frankly, because as I mentioned earlier, gas is such an efficient way to make power these days. And natural gas has been super cheap, relatively speaking, for a long time since the fracking revolution really created this excess amount of natural gas in this country. But overall, on a net basis, I think we have a little less baseload capacity now than we did in the past few years. We've added more of those intermittent resources. Still, roughly 80% of what we're generating in this country, 80 to 85%, is in that baseload category. It's coal, it's gas, it's nuclear, and some always running hydro. That gets you up to about 85% of all the generation in this country. So we still have the vast majority of our generation always available.
Can you guess how much money it would take to build the transmission system up to the mark of what demand is going to be?
Oh my gosh, there are studies all over the place that throw out different numbers. And so there's not a consensus on one number for what it would cost, but we're talking in the range of, you know, tens of billions of dollars, if not hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, it's such a massive amount.
It's a sidebar question, but I think it's appropriate for anyone who's been watching the Weather Channel or other elements of Mom Nature this spring. It seems like we've had an increase in severe weather. How much challenge has that provided for your co-ops in specific regions?
Well, there's no question that it creates challenges. What's interesting is, look, it matters in the summer when it's extreme heat, and it matters in the winter when it's extreme cold. But lately, we've seen the challenges really manifest themselves in the winter. And here's why it's been a bigger problem is because when it's a real heavy cold snap, when that polar vortex hits, the demand for natural gas, just to heat homes, to keep people warm, the demand for natural gas is so significant during those spikes that there are times when there isn't enough gas to run the power plants. And this happened, this was a little while ago, it was December of 2022 on Christmas Eve, but it happened in the sort of nine states, the Mid-Atlantic area. We had rolling blackouts. We had, I know one of our electric cooperative members had a natural gas-fired plant. They had firm contract for that gas, and there was no gas to burn. There was no gas to burn because the cold made a situation where so much of the home heating use of gas, which is going to be a priority. This isn't theoretical. We've actually seen this happen. We're having a discussion about the electric grid and electric needs. The other need we got to build beyond electric transmission lines is we need more gas pipeline capacity in this country, too, because I believe natural gas is going to continue to be a very critical fuel for electric production for the foreseeable future.
I want to give credit to the New York Times for this headline. I didn't think of it, and that is the energy need of the nation versus our climate goals. Is there a way to balance this challenge, and is the administration's approach with their new rules on power plant emissions an effective way to keep that balance?
Well, the answer to your first question, is there a way to balance that? I think the answer is yes. And is the administration doing it the right way? The answer is no. Let me elaborate. I think it's unfortunate that this issue, often the frame of how we make power and dealing with climate issues, that it's a binary choice. You have to get when the Biden administration came into office, they said, we want the electric sector to be at zero carbon emissions by 2035. That can't be done without significantly compromising the reliability of the grid. Not when roughly 70, 80% of the power we use these days comes from coal and natural gas. On the other hand, there are ways to make progress that where you can have a reliable electric system if we get out of this all or none, zero or 100 conversation. Electrification of our economy provides huge opportunities for carbon reduction for our economy. Electric vehicles, electric heat pumps, switching on in agriculture from gas-fired irrigation pumps to electric pumps. There's all kinds of ways that we can reduce broader carbon emissions in this country if we use electricity. But you can't at the same time say, but we're going to take electricity down to zero and lose our reliability. That's not good news at all. So I do think there is an opportunity for a balanced and pragmatic approach that can make progress in both respects. But as I said, when Biden administration came in, they said, we want zero emissions from the electric sector by 2035. And they have taken what I call a whole of government approach to pursue that agenda from a regulatory standpoint, from various requirements. That's where they want to go. And they're proposing rules that we think, first of all, outside the boundaries of what they can do legally. In fact, in terms of the EPA, most recent regulation the EPA has put forth, we are now suing the EPA because we think it violates the Clean Air Act. But also, regulations are not grounded in reality in terms of what's achievable. You can't propose regulations on technologies that you hope are going to be available in a few years. In fact, legally, you have to say it's a proven technology before you require it. And that's the path I think that the administration has followed to there, saying we want to hope we're going to require this and hopefully, you know, it's the old cliche from Field of Dreams, you build it, they will come. It's, if we mandate it, the technology will evolve. I don't think that's a risk we want to take with our power grid. So that's my concern with the way the Biden administration's approached this issue.
So two comments, and they are obviously on opposite sides of this issue. Senator Shelley Moore Capito says they'll shut down the backbone of America's electric grid through unachievable mandates. That's one. The other from the EPA Administrator Michael Regan, confidently prepare for the future without sacrificing affordable, reliable energy.
Yeah, I have to say, I think these rules do not present a future where we can have the count on our reliability and maintain affordability. I disagree with what the EPA administrator is saying. That doesn't mean we can't make investments to have a portfolio within our overall electric grid in this country that has a lower carbon footprint going forward in various ways. As I said, zero carbon resources, particularly renewables, have a role as part of portfolio. In the long run, quite candidly, nuclear's got to be the option if you really want to move the needle in the electric sector in terms of carbon emissions. And nuclear is a tough nut to crack these days. I think it's really important that we continue to try to do that, but you haven't seen many new nuclear plants built in this country over the last few decades. They're really expensive, and there are other more cost-effective ways to go about generating electricity, and that's why you've seen such few plants built. At the end of the day, this rule and the timeframes and the technologies that they assume are unrealistic, unachievable, and as I said, this, from our perspective, unlawful, and that's why we're litigating on the rule.
So let's talk about the rule. Existing coal and natural gas plants would reduce carbon dioxide emissions by 90% by 2032. If a plant is scheduled to close by 2039, it'd have to cut by 16% by 2030, and if they're going to retire by 2032, then they're exempt of the rule. How will it affect the generation of electricity as you see it?
First of all, this is the rule. The EPA published a draft of it. They took in public comment, and now they publish what is called the final rule. So that is the law. That's why, in addition to litigating this, we filed suit against the law in general. We've also gone to the courts in the past week and asked for an immediate stay to prevent this from being the law, because we think it creates irreparable harm in the short term. And, you know, when you throw out those years like 2032 and 2039, sometimes that sounds like a long ways away. But I'm here to tell you, in the electric business, we make decisions that have long tails. You know, I mean, when you want to build a new resource, you got to take years to deal with the planning, the permitting, the siting, the construction. This is actually not a long ways away in terms of decisions we have to make in the utility sector. And this rule, we think, creates unrealistic timelines. It also mandates a particular technology that's called carbon capture and sequestration. And simply put, it's technologies where you capture carbon before it's emitted out the stack, and then you put it underground to sequester it, if you will, and store it underground. So that's carbon capture and sequestration. Look, for both coal and gas plants, they're requiring it. And carbon capture sequestration is an idea and a technology that's been talked about for a long time in this country. And it may be promising, and I hope someday it gets really viable. But it is not proven to be viable today. And even if you build one, it's certainly not proven to meet the emissions restriction that the rule says, which is you got to be, by 2039, you got to be at 90% reduction on your carbon dioxide emission. That is not a proven technology, but that's what the rule is asking for. So we're in a tough spot, quite frankly, the utility sector in terms of making decisions, because if they don't give the stay, that's the law right now, and waiting for the litigation to play out, which as we all know can take a long time, that puts everyone in a state of uncertainty, you know, kind of a state of limbo where you're trying to figure out what to do. That's not good for anybody in the face of this skyrocketing electric demand that we discussed a few minutes ago. This country's thirst for electricity is mushrooming right now, driven by these new data centers. And by the way, artificial intelligence is going to create even more demand for electricity. So we're right in the face of this huge increase in demand. We've got this EPA rule creating uncertainty and extremely difficult circumstances for the electric utility sector.
What are the consequences of this rule?
The consequences are less reliable and more costly electricity for the American consumer.
Can we assume that these are unfunded mandates that are coming with this law?
Well, you raise a really interesting question because, you know, when you're making a rule for a government agency, and we're seeing this happen more and more in the federal government over years, by the way, in different administrations, you know, they only have so many tools in their toolbox. They can set requirements, but they can't offer funding. That's up to Congress. And quite frankly, a lot of these issues ought to be dealt with in Congress, in my opinion. But we all know that Congress isn't reflecting a lot of productive activity. It's more gridlocked than anything. So there are funding programs out there that weren't associated with this rule that came out of the EPA. But there may be some funding opportunities through the Department of Energy and whatnot to make some of these investments. But to circle back to the meat of your question, no. The EPA can't offer funding to help make this happen. By statute, they can't do that. And therein lies one of the great challenges when these decisions are made purely by the executive branch as opposed to Congress making these decisions.
So let me introduce a topic that is coming before the Supreme Court, Chevron deference. Do you feel like this is a place where the EPA is going beyond their authority?
Absolutely. And quite frankly, that's one of the foundational aspects of the litigation we filed against the EPA for that very reason.
What does all this mean toward the electric cooperatives and electricity users in the country?
Well, it means we're going to need a lot more electricity, and it's not clear where it's going to come from. And particularly when it comes to these artificial intelligence facilities that use so much computer power, they're located a lot in the rural areas where cooperatives are. So we're going to see a disproportionate of that affect rural electric cooperatives from what we can see. And the thing about artificial intelligence is it's happening. You know, I don't want to get into if that's a good thing, bad thing, or obviously there are trade-offs. But at the end of the day, we want it to be here in the United States. We do not want artificial intelligence to establish its most significant footprints in other countries around the world. There is a national security and economic security argument that we really do want to embrace this and have it happen here. And if we're going to do that, we're going to need a lot more electric generation to make that happen. So on the one hand, you can say from a policy perspective, the administration can say, yeah, we're all for AI and we want to support it. But you can't have other agencies promoting rules and new laws that really make it that much more difficult to accommodate this new growth and demand from artificial intelligence.
Do you find legislators that are supportive of your plight and are willing to take this measure on? And do you think they could get the votes to overturn it?
Clearly, there are a lot of people in the legislative branch that understand this issue because, you know, at various levels, it's really complicated. At a certain level, it's pretty straightforward. It's the basic laws of supply and demand. And demand is growing. Supply is not keeping up. In some cases, we're shutting down power plants before the end of their useful life. So we're making that supply-demand relationship even worse. So in that context, yes, I think a lot of people are starting to understand the importance of this issue. Where we get some division of opinion is, we can make up for it with lots of solar and wind and batteries. And as I said a couple of times, that can be part of a portfolio that can have some value, but it doesn't meet the actual needs of being totally reliable for this growth that we face. Now, I wish I could tell you as a result, yeah, Congress is all set. They can vote to fix this. I don't think the votes are there to change this in the short term. I just don't. So that's why in terms specifically for what EPA is doing, we're going to the other branch of government, which is the judicial branch, and we're litigating this to see if we can get this taken down, because we think that's, as even though litigation takes time, we think that's the most achievable and timely option we've got at our disposal right now. But I will say this. I think it is incumbent on Congress, and this shouldn't be a red or blue or a Republican or Democrat issue. I think it's incumbent on Congress to really take a step back and say, you know, electrification of this country and making sure that we can meet the needs of AI and data centers in this country and new manufacturing we're bringing onshore, those are all good things for this country. And I'd like to think whatever people's politics are, we could rally around the fact that this is a good thing for the future of this country. But I'd be overstating if I said there's consensus in Congress today.
Well, it's clear that climate change are the golden headline and the golden measure with regard to swaying voters. And there is also the assumption that they're always going to be able to flip a switch and there's always going to be enough electricity there.
And I hope we could have a reasoned conversation to say that you've got to address both. You know, it's not an all or none or an either or. I think we need to be careful about framing it in that simplistic way, because life is not that simple and these issues are clearly not that simple. There are steps we can take to make progress on both, and we ought to have that as, in my opinion, the goal that everyone in this discussion ought to share. You follow politics. You see it out there every day. Everything's framed in these all or none frameworks. And we're not going to make progress if we talk about these issues in that way.
And this is not a viable viable argument, but it should be pointed out that China's building coal plants right now. Well, we're shutting them down. China's emitting more carbon than the rest of the developed world, than the U.S. And we're talking about making decisions that could be a challenge for our way of life and certainly for our economic development and national security.
It is one of those things we need to remind ourselves, is that, you know, the climate change issue is a global issue. And we are one of many players in that discussion. China is making significant investments in renewable energy as well. But there's no question that they're a significant emitter of carbon. And this is a much, I've said it two or three times, this is a very complicated issue, and we got to stop talking about it in simplistic terms, because everything we do in the United States doesn't affect what happens to the rest of the world.
Well, Jim, for so many million Americans who assume that when they flip the switch or when they plug in, there's going to be power there, we thank you for your work and the work of the cooperative system across the nation. Thank you for this conversation today, some very challenging issues. This is Open Mic, and you've been here before, and you deserve the opportunity to have the last word today.
Well, first, I just appreciate any effort for you to help highlight this issue. These are important issues, and they are complicated issues, as we've discussed. And so having a podcast where we can take the time to kind of talk through them really is helpful in terms of creating greater awareness and education. That's what we're all about at the Rural Electric Cooperatives, and I just really appreciate you're providing a platform for us to raise these issues.
Our thanks to Jim Matheson, CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by Modern Ag Alliance. Learn more at their website, controlweedsnotfarming.com. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nellie.